Imagine trying to navigate this sprawling, constantly changing city, but you're stubbornly using a map printed in, like, 2010.
Oh, that sounds like a nightmare.
Right. The map insists there's a bridge ahead, so you confidently drive forward, completely ignoring the fact that your own eyes are looking directly at a massive empty
Yeah,
canyon.
you're going right over the edge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we do this all the time with cultural narratives.
Yeah.
You know, we trust the old familiar map of how the world supposedly works, even when the hard data sitting right in front of us paints a completely different picture.
We really do.
So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are unpacking a super fascinating stack of commentary today. Specifically, we've got a massive data roundup from economics writer Noah Smith, paired with a deeply philosophical essay from Jonah Goldberg.
Yeah, and on the surface, those sound like they belong in entirely different libraries. I mean, one is throwing hard economic charts and cybersecurity data at us, and the other is pulling 19th century German philosophy into modern political commentary.
Right. It's a wild mix.
But they actually orbit this central, really powerful theme. It's the clash between our accepted doom narratives and reality.
Yeah.
They're both looking at areas where society has basically thrown its hands up and accepted that we are helpless, helpless against artificial intelligence, against generational poverty, or even against the supposedly unstoppable forces of history. And they are systematically pointing out that, hey, human agency still matters.
I really love how both of these pieces are grounded in real, immediate human experience, too. Like, these aren't just abstract theories typed out in an ivory tower somewhere.
Yeah, not at all.
Noah Smith's data roundup includes this very raw note that he just lost his father to chemotherapy
Oh,
complications.
wow. Yeah.
And Jonah Goldberg is writing his philosophical critique while in the middle of this highly stressful cross-country move to LA with a pack of anxious dogs.
Right, which anyone who has moved with pets knows is just chaos.
Total chaos. It just reminds you that behind all these grand theories of macroeconomic history and political destiny, there are just real people trying to navigate a rapidly changing, sometimes really painful world. Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the map we seem most stubbornly attached to. The idea that the younger generations are just completely financially ruined.
Ah, the generation screwed narrative. I mean, it is so deeply embedded in our culture that questioning it almost feels like a taboo.
It really does. The way people talk about it, the modern economy is like a video game where the developers released a patch that drastically increased the XP required to level up.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Yeah, so the players in this case, millennials, feel like the game is rigged against them from the start because the friction is so much higher than it was for previous players.
Right.
But what that narrative totally misses is that the loot drops, like the actual wages being earned, are significantly higher too. And that brings us to the stunning data Noah Smith highlights from economists Corinth and Larimore.
Yeah, their findings completely shatter the doom narrative. When you look at millennial real median household income, meaning income adjusted for inflation, it is actually 20% higher than the previous generation at the exact same age.
But really, 20% higher.
20%. The median millennial household is objectively wealthier than Gen X or boomer households were at that exact same stage of life.
I mean, I struggle to square that 20% number with the reality of housing costs and student loans. Those are massive financial burdens that, you know, previous generations didn't face to nearly the same degree. How are they achieving a 20% increase in real wealth despite those massive headwinds?
Well, it comes down to structural shifts in the labor market and demographics. Yes, housing in major coastal cities is absolutely exorbitant, and student loan debt is a unique friction point.
Yeah, a huge one.
But millennials are the most educated generation in history, which means a larger percentage of them shifted into the higher paying knowledge economy. Furthermore, you have to look at household composition.
Felt like dual incomes.
Exactly. You have a higher rate of dual income households, and women's labor force participation and earning power have grown significantly compared to the boomer era.
So the narrative basically hyper-focuses on the specific costs that have skyrocketed, like housing and education, while completely ignoring the massive surge in overall earning power that more than compensates for it on a median level.
Precisely. The doom narrative prevents us from seeing the absolute wealth because we are so fixated on the structural friction.
That makes a lot of sense.
But that massive blind spot that makes us panic over fake millennial poverty is dangerous because it distracts us from the very real financial monster that is staring us right in the face.
You mean the U.S. national debt?
Yeah.
Because if we want to talk about mathematically terrifying scenarios, the debt held by the public just passed 100% of GDP for the first time since World War II.
Which is wild.
We owe more than the entire country produces in a single year.
And the scale of it is just hard to conceptualize. I mean, the debt is now roughly 8 times our annual tax revenue. But the mechanism of why this suddenly matters right now, why it's a monster today and maybe wasn't 10 years ago, is interest.
Because rates went up.
Exactly. For a long time, borrowing was cheap. But debt doesn't just sit there. As old bonds mature, the government has to roll them over. They issue new debt to pay off the old debt.
Right.
The problem is they are now rolling over that massive pile of debt at today's much higher interest rates.
Which means the interest payments alone start devouring the federal budget.
Right.
Crowding out spending on infrastructure, defense, social programs.
Absolutely.
And if you're wondering how our political leaders are handling this, the sources make it clear that there is a systemic failure across the board.
Yeah, it's pretty glaring.
And just to maintain strict neutrality here, we are just looking at the math and the policy actions. Mm. The DOGE initiative, the Department of Government Efficiency effort, failed to make the necessary deep cuts.
Right.
Donald Trump is engaging in massive deficit spending, and Democrats are simultaneously promising new tax cuts. Nobody's willing to hit the brakes.
Well, hitting the brakes requires inflicting short-term political pain, which literally no one wants to own.
So true.
So we are left in this bizarre cultural moment. We spend our energy panicking over a mathematically debunked narrative about generational poverty,
yeah,
while completely ignoring the sovereign debt crisis just rolling over us in real time.
That same exact dynamic, panicking over the wrong threat because we feel helpless, is perfectly mirrored in our relationship with technology.
Oh, absolutely.
We constantly feel powerless against massive technological forces, especially artificial intelligence. Like, the recent news cycle made it sound like AI was an alien entity about to dismantle the global power grid.
Yeah, Noah Smith's Roundup covers that panic beautifully. It was sparked by the release of Anthropic's Claude Mythos model and compounded when the UK AI Security Institute evaluated OpenAI's GPT-5.5.
Oh, right, the hacking stuff.
Yeah, the institute noted the model had highly advanced autonomous hacking capabilities.
And the immediate cultural reaction was just that we are entirely defenseless,
mm-hmm,
that an AI can think a million times faster than a human, so it will inevitably breach every secure server on Earth before we even know we're under attack.
What's fascinating here is that a week post-release, no catastrophic attacks materialized.
Nothing happened.
Nothing. In fact, when we look at the broader research on cyber incidents, the costs associated with cyber catastrophes have actually declined.
Wait, declined?
Yes. The doom narrative assumes that a new technology only scales the offense. But the underlying theory of AI and cybersecurity suggests it might actually privilege defense over offense.
That actually makes intuitive sense when you break down how enterprise cybersecurity functions.
Yeah.
It isn't just a single locked door. Systems use a concept called defense in depth.
Right.
Think of vulnerabilities in a system as finite. There are only so many open windows in a massive office building. An AI attacker can scan and find an open window incredibly fast.
Yeah.
But once it gets through that window, it hits a secure internal firewall, then an encrypted database, then an anomaly detection system monitoring traffic.
Exactly. And the defenders are also armed with AI. The defense of AI is constantly patching those finite vulnerabilities, monitoring the internal sensors, and isolating threats.
Right. It's not a one-sided fight.
For an offensive AI to cause a catastrophe, it has to successfully bypass every single layer of that defense-in-depth system consecutively without triggering a single alarm.
Which is incredibly hard.
The technology doesn't just scale the threat, it scales the immunity. A layered defensive system is structurally more robust than we fear.
So we aren't helpless. And it's fascinating to see this realization, this reclaiming of agency translating from the digital cloud right into our physical environment.
Oh, the schools.
Yes. Look at what is happening with smartphones in schools.
Mm-hmm.
For a decade, the prevailing attitude was total surrender.
Yeah, it really was.
The technology existed. The network effects of social media were too strong. And administrators acted like there was absolutely nothing they could do.
It was a perfect example of accepting inevitable decline. But the data shows what happens when society finally exercises its agency. 35 states have now enacted some form of school phone restriction.
35? That's huge.
Yeah. NOAA highlights a randomized controlled trial following 17,000 students. When phones are restricted during the school day, the researchers saw a 0.086 standard deviation improvement in grades.
Wow. But isn't there an argument that we're just delaying the inevitable? Like, if a kid gets their phone back at 3 p.m. and immediately jumps on social media, are we actually solving the problem or just pausing it for a few hours?
The pause is exactly what matters because it relieves a massive cognitive load during the crucial learning window. Social media is an unrelenting comparative engine.
Oh, for sure.
It constantly ranks social status, appearance, and wealth. For students, particularly girls from lower socioeconomic backgrounds who showed the highest benefit in the study, that comparative pressure is just exhausting.
So by instituting a blanket ban during school hours, the administration is providing a socially acceptable out. The student doesn't have to make the agonizing choice to disconnect and risk social exile. The institutional rule does it for them.
Exactly. It temporarily shatters the toxic network effect so their brain can actually focus on algebra.
And that institutional intervention is yielding not just academic improvements, but significant boosts in psychological well-being.
Yeah, the mental health benefits are clear.
It is a profound shift toward a mature techno-optimism. Not the blind optimism that worships every new gadget, but the optimism that human society is capable of metabolizing, regulating, and pushing back against new tools when necessary.
So what does this all mean?
To me, it's like we spent years trying to teach kids how to tread water in a flooded room, convinced that the rise in water was just an unstoppable force of nature, and finally society just walked over and turned off the tap.
That's a great way to put it.
But to be fair to the sources, reclaiming our agency also means looking objectively at where the water is doing damage. We can't let our newfound optimism blind us to the areas where tech is causing immediate structural disruption.
Right. And the data indicates that the entry-level knowledge economy is where the armor is cracking. We aren't seeing a sci-fi apocalypse, but we are seeing a highly targeted compression of the job market.
Yeah, Goldman Sachs data is showing a noticeable drag on hiring.
The specific numbers from the Tucker 2026 study paint a stark picture. They found a 12% employment decline in the most AI-exposed fields, specifically for workers aged 22 to 24.
12% for young workers. That's rough.
And when you look at the Crane and Soto research from 2026, coder employment growth is 3% lower than the baseline since the launch of ChatGPT.
Which forces us to identify AI's first true killer app. For decades, we were told that learning to code was the ultimate future-proof skill, right?
Oh, yeah, learn to code. Everyone said it.
But coding turns out to be exceptionally vulnerable to large language models.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's because coding is entirely syntax and logic-based. It is a rule-bound environment.
Right.
LLMs struggle with ambiguous, messy physical reality, but they are exceptionally good at generating, predicting, and debugging boilerplate code in a predictable environment.
That is the crucial mechanism. The disruption isn't the Terminator taking over a factory. It is a senior software engineer using an LLM to generate basic boilerplate code in 10 seconds, code that previously would have been assigned to a 23-year-old junior developer fresh out of college.
Exactly. The bottom rung of the knowledge work ladder is being automated away.
So our agency needs to be focused on adapting to that localized reality. How do we train the next generation when the entry-level tasks they used to cut their teeth on are now handled by software?
That's a huge challenge.
Reclaiming entry-level jobs requires structural adaptation, and that same principle of structural change applies to reclaiming our physical spaces too. The doom narrative around American cities, particularly regarding public decay and stagnation, is incredibly thick.
Oh, yeah. We are repeatedly told that urban decline is an unstoppable force. But Noah Smith points to a fantastic case study proving that public order works and cities can choose to enforce it.
You're talking about BART.
Yes, the BART transit system in the Bay Area recently installed new hardened fare gates to prevent fare evasion.
And this was a massive political battle, right?
Yeah.
A vocal progressive opposition fought the installation of these gates, arguing that strict fare enforcement would essentially criminalize poverty and disproportionately harm vulnerable populations who couldn't afford the train.
They did. Yet the results post-installation are undeniable. The system generated $10 million a year in additional revenue.
Wow.
They required 1,000 fewer cleaning hours because the stations physically remained cleaner. And most importantly, there was a massive 41% drop in crime within the transit system.
Wait, 41%? How does a simple fare gate translate to a 41% drop in crime? It's not just about stopping someone from stealing a $3 ride.
It creates a physical barrier of public order. Fare evasion is often the leading indicator of other antisocial behaviors. By establishing a baseline of enforcement at the perimeter, you drastically reduce the volume of disruptive activity inside the system.
That makes sense.
And Noah's underlying argument here is critical. The opposition feared hurting the poor, but the reality is that lax enforcement of rules actually hurts the poorest citizens the most.
Because wealthy citizens have options. They can take an Uber, they can drive a private car, or they can simply move. The most vulnerable populations rely entirely on the public commons.
Exactly.
When the public commons becomes dangerous or degraded, they absorb the absolute brunt of that impact. Restoring order to public transit is one of the most effective ways to protect vulnerable people.
It is a clear example of local government exercising agency, and we see that same agency breaking through the stagnation of the housing crisis. We have been told for decades that NMBYs, you know, the not in my backyard crowd, are an unstoppable force.
Using local zoning laws to prevent new housing and drive up prices forever.
Here's where it gets really interesting. M. Nolan Gray's data shows the YMBYs, the Yes in My Backyard pro-housing movement, are actually winning in places like California.
They're building.
Over 150,000 accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, have been permitted, with 80,000 already built. And the state density bonus law has generated over 140,000 units since 2020.
So how did they bypass the local stagnation?
The YMBY movement elevated the agency to the state level. California passed laws that essentially preempted local zoning boards. If a housing project meets certain criteria, the state law overrides the local NMBY veto.
Oh, wow. So cities like Berkeley and San Luis Obispo are building at scale now.
Yes. The battle isn't completely over. The sources note that some cities are trying to use exorbitant impact fees and strict inclusionary zoning mandates as a backdoor way to stop development.
Right.
But the core point remains. The doom narrative of we can't build anymore is empirically false. When we change the rules, action overcomes stagnation.
Which brings us to the most abstract, yet perhaps the most crucial part of today's deep dive. We have established that human choices matter on the ground. We can ban phones. We can install transit gates. We can pass state housing laws.
Yeah, we can do all of that.
So why do we increasingly project total fatalism onto our national politics? Why do we treat political movements as if they are driven by unstoppable magical forces of history?
This perfectly sets up Jonah Goldberg's essay. He is pushing back hard against a recent trend in political commentary. Specifically, he critiques an article in The Atlantic and writings by John Judis that try to frame Donald Trump as a Hegelian world historical figure.
And just to be clear, Goldberg's critique isn't about whether Trump is good or bad policy-wise. He is critiquing the philosophical framework we use to understand him.
Right, exactly.
For those of us who didn't spend 4 years dissecting 19th century German philosophy, what does it actually mean to call someone a world historical figure in the Hegelian sense, like Caesar or Napoleon?
Well, Hegel believed that history wasn't just a random sequence of chaotic events. He believed it had a distinct direction guided by what he called the world spirit. This spirit was constantly, inevitably moving human society forward toward a more ethical, rational, and free order.
So it's a deeply progressive, optimistic view of human destiny, rooted entirely in Enlightenment ideals.
Exactly. And a world historical figure, in Hegel's view, is an individual who concentrates that world spirit and violently pushes history into a new epoch.
Okay.
The key mechanism is unintended consequences. Hegel used Napoleon as the prime example. Napoleon wasn't trying to spread freedom and rationality. He was trying to conquer Europe for his own ego.
Right.
But in doing so, his armies inadvertently smashed the old feudal systems and spread the rational legal ideals of the French Revolution. He was the vehicle for the world spirit, regardless of his personal motivations.
So these modern analysts are trying to map that architecture onto Donald Trump. They are arguing he is this historical wrecking ball pushing us into a new era. Wait, but I struggle to see the connection. When asked about the long-term legacy of his movement, Trump literally says, "I'll be dead." That doesn't sound like the grand, optimistic architecture of Hegel, right? That sounds more like Nietzschean nihilism, a belief in nothing but the exercise of raw power in the present moment, with no concern for building a more rational future order.
This raises an important question. That is Goldberg's exact critique. How far can you stretch a philosophy before it breaks completely? To make the Trump as Hegel comparison work, these analysts have to surgically remove Hegel's Enlightenment optimism. Hmm. They keep the wrecking ball aspect, but discard the idea that history is moving toward a more ethical, rational order.
And if you take the optimism out of Hegel,
yeah.
You just have a guy breaking things, you've gutted the entire philosophy.
Furthermore, Goldberg points out that modern populism, particularly the Magyar movement, is not Hegelian in its desires. Hegel is about moving inevitably forward to a new, loftier epoch. A Make America Great Again movement, by its very definition, is nostalgic.
It's looking backward.
It is about going backward to reclaim a lost past. It is fundamentally incompatible with Hegelian forward motion.
But Goldberg doesn't just go after the analysts trying to dress Trump up in Hegelian progress. He also goes after the conservative writers on the other side of the coin, like Ross Douthat, who view Trump not as a driver of the future, but as an inevitable marker of societal decadence and decline.
Right, because both of those frameworks, the optimistic progress and the pessimistic decline, share the exact same fatal flaw. They deny human agency.
Yes. Whether you believe history is an unstoppable upward escalator driven by a magical world spirit, or an unstoppable downward spiral of Roman-style decadence, you are letting yourself off the hook. You are saying, the forces of history are too big, my choices don't matter.
And Goldberg's ultimate conclusion is a total rejection of that fatalism. He writes, decline is a choice, and so is ascent.
That is the perfect summary of this entire journey today. When you step back and look at all these incredibly diverse sources, the pattern is undeniable. From millennials leveraging the knowledge economy to defy the generation screwed narrative, to the fact that AI cyber threats are currently being bottlenecked by layered defenses, to the very real immediate impact of just turning off the phones in a middle school, or installing physical fare gates to make a transit system safe again.
All the way up to rejecting the philosophical trap that our national politics are just the whim of sick 19th century world spirit. The economic data, the sociological research, and the philosophy all point to one single truth. Do not surrender to the narrative of inevitability.
We are not driving blindfolded, forced to follow a broken map into a canyon. We have our hands on the wheel. We can steer. But we have to be willing to look at the actual landscape instead of the glowing screen of cultural panic.
Exactly.
So I want to leave you with a thought to chew on as you go about your day. Think about an area in your own life, or maybe in your specific industry, where everyone has simply accepted a narrative of inevitable decline or unstoppable disruption. What if that's just a philosophical trap? What small real-world fare gate or phone ban could you implement tomorrow to reclaim your agency in that space?
It's the ultimate question. The future isn't a disaster movie we are strapped to a chair and forced to watch. It is something we are actively building.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Go challenge a doom narrative today, and we'll catch you next time.